Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 4, 2019. Let the record reflect time is 1:36 p.m. Today we have President Senator Kawasaki, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, myself, Chair Schauer. Senator Reinbold will not be with us. Her brother passed away, I believe it was yesterday or the night before, of heart failure. So she will not be here for a few days with us. I just want to put that on the record that she is home taking care of family and doing what she needs to do. Senator Michikee has another meeting that's running over. He'll join us a little bit later. I'd like to remind everybody in the room, please silence or turn off your cell phones. The staff that will be assisting us today, we have Carrie of Senate Records and Eric behind us with the LIO. We have multiple items on today's agenda, and we're going to get initial rollout hearing and have public testimony for the following bills, possibly move one or two of them. SB 78, established May 31st as Katie John Day. SB 92, PFD contributions to the general fund. SB 40, Black History Month. If time allows, we'll get back to SJR 5, constitutional amendment, permanent fund, and dividend, and possibly SB 32, crime sentencing, mental illness, and evidence, since today we have the long marathon session, which could be up to 3 hours long. I'd also like to remind everybody that we'll be recessing sometime after we go, probably after those first three bills, and we'll come back at 3:30, not later than, to continue with the agenda. First, we're going to get initial rollout of SB 78, established Katie John Day by Senator Bishop. This time I'd like to call the table the staff for Senator Bishop. If you could place your name and title on the record and begin once you get up here. You know the drill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate this opportunity to present to you Senate Bill 78. Unfortunately, Senator Bishop also has a tragedy that he's dealing with, similar to Senator Reinbold. So my prayers go out to Senator Reinbold as well as Senator Bishop. Therefore, I'm presenting this bill to you, and thank you for your consideration. Senate Bill 78 proposes to amend Alaska Statutes Title 44, Chapter 12 by adding a new section designating May 31st as Katie John Day in honor of her legacy.
Question. Can you put yourself on the record as well?
Yes, I'm sorry. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Bishop. Thank you, sir. Katie John was a highly respected Athabascan elder from Mentasta Lake. She passed away on May 31st, 2013 at the age of 97. Katie John grew up on the banks of the Copper River near the present-day community of Slana and the seasonal fishing village of Batsulmenes. Her parents were Otna Chief Charlie Sanford and Sarah Sanford. Katie John was raised off the land like her ancestors. She was a consummate teacher of her ancestral traditions, culture, and history. She was a member of the Otna Regional Native Corporation. She was very passionate about preserving the Athabascan culture. And she was also very involved in the preservation and teachings of her Athabascan language and helped create the first alphabet for the Otna dialect. Katie John became well known throughout Alaska and became a household name starting in 1985 when she and another Athabascan elder, Doris Charles, filed suit against the state of Alaska in federal court to resolve a longstanding quarrel over customary and traditional fishing rights. The dispute arose in 1964 after the State Board of Fish banned subsistence fishing in Batsulmenes, which is located on the Copper River at the confluence of Tanata Creek. This village site had been used for hundreds of years by the Otna people to harvest sockeye salmon. The case against the state went through many iterations, and ultimately another lawsuit, Katie John versus the United States, was filed in 1990 on behalf of Katie John, Doris Charles, and the Mentasta Village Council. The Katie John case, as it became widely known, was brought forward in the hopes of broadening the definition of public lands in Section 102 of ANILCA to include navigable waters. ANILCA is the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Carter in 1980. The Katie John case also sought the creation of a federal subsistence fishery in the Batsulmenes area, which was included in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park through the passage of ANILCA. This case also went through many iterations and appeals, but ultimately it was resolved on July 3, 2013, when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision that during times of shortage, the federal government may provide a rural subsistence fishing priority on navigable waters in Alaska. Finally, on March 31, 2014, the United States Supreme Court ultimately decided to reject a petition filed by the state of Alaska to overturn Katie John, bringing to a close almost three decades of litigation. Sadly, Katie John did not live long enough to witness the final resolution of her peaceful struggle to preserve the traditional way of life for her people. And with the passage of Senate Bill 78, we can do our part to honor her legacy and the accomplishments of her life's work. Katie John and her husband, Chief Fred John, who passed away in 2000, they raised 14 children and 6 foster children. Together, they leave behind approximately 250 grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. In your packets, we have letters and resolutions of support from the Mentasta Traditional Council and the Alaska Federation of Natives. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for showing up today to give us the introduction to the bill. And I'll open up to the committee for questions. Comments. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. On some days, we honor people on their birth date, and other times we honor them on their death. Or why are we honoring her on her death rather than her birthday?
That was a request by the Alaska Federation of Natives in the resolution that they passed. It's to honor her passing, and I think it's also to recognize the fact that her untimely passing happened just a year prior to the final resolution of her lifelong battle.
Anyone else? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I signed on as a co-sponsor of this mainly because the wonderful tenacity of this lady really should be honored. I don't know that the fight's totally over, but there are questions that they got settled at the Supreme Court level that I think are going to be important for Alaska going forward. So I've been arguing against the Katie John decision, not against Katie John so much, but her lifelong battle is proof of what I said the other day about trailblazers. You get a few times in life where somebody gets on an issue and then people just fall in behind that individual. And certainly her name now is famous to Alaskans and worthy of all the honor. So argue as we may about all the details, you cannot argue the greatness of one individual. And this particular one is worthy of all that honor. So that's one of the reasons I signed on to it.
Okay. Seeing no other comments at this time, we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. We've got no one, it looks like, in the room to testify, but we do have a number of callers from offline. Jake, can you just give me the two-minute timer, please? And we're going to start with Catherine Martin from Otna and Mentasta. Catherine, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you, Senator Spauer.
Yes, ma'am, if you just put yourself on the record with your name, and I'm going to ask everybody to hold it to about 2 minutes for the number to get through, and provide us your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name's Catherine Martin. I'm Senior Vice President of Otna Incorporated, but I'm also one of the granddaughters to Katie John. And I just wanted to say that we want to support this bill. And we've also had asked Representative Neil Foster to push it on the House side also. And we just wanted this recognition for Grandma Katie, just to honor and recognize what she has done for all the Native people, for Alaska, for subsistence. And I heard the question, why we picked May 31st. For the Otna region, at midnight, that is the day we are able to turn on our fish wheels in the region, so that's another reason why that day was picked.
Outstanding.
And I'll just leave it at that.
Catherine, it's good to hear your voice, and thanks for taking the time to call in this evening.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to switch now to Michelle Anderson, also from Otna and Mentasta. So, Michelle, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. Loud and clear. Go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Anderson, and I'm president for Otna Incorporated. We happen to be here in Mentasta Village
which I think is maybe not coincidence that the day of this hearing also happens to be when we're here. So I feel like Grandma Katie is a part of what we're doing. ANNA Incorporated and many others, we've been trying to get May 31st named in honor of Katie John since a year after her passing, and I do want to thank Representative Neil Foster for helping us. I am so thankful that Senator Bishop is assisting, and you know, both gentlemen realize the importance of recognizing our Alaska Native leaders. We have huge history in Alaska, and it's pretty rare to find any day where any of our people are recognized. Katie John is a civil rights leader in my mind, not just to Alaska Natives, but to all Alaskans. She stood her ground. She stood for fighting for traditional fishing rights. And, you know, she is known by her name. Very few Alaskans have that prestige and honor. And, you know, not just for those of us who are alive today, I want people for generations down the road to know who she was, how important she was to all of us, and that she deserves her day of recognition. So thank you. Thank you to the committee for listening.
Thank you, Michelle. It's good to hear your voice, and thanks for taking the time to call in. It looks like we've got several coming in from Mintassa to make their voices heard. We'll switch over now to Nicholas Ovtrovsky in Mintassa as well. Nicholas, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nicholas Ostrovsky. I am managing counsel for ANNA Incorporated. And I'll keep this brief. I know the committee's time is precious. Katie John spearheaded the most significant legislation over subsistence and perhaps cultural rights in Alaska history. And her tenacity and willingness to stand up for her people helped to protect the customary and traditional way of life for all Alaska Natives, not just her people. And it's fitting to mark a day to honor this woman who gave so much for all Alaska Native people and effectively changed how subsistence hunting and fishing is defined in Alaska today. So thank you.
Thanks, Nicholas, for taking the time to call in this evening. We have Eileen Iwan in Mintassa as well. Eileen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yes, ma'am. If you put yourself on the record with your name and provide testimony, please.
My name is Eileen Iwan, and I'm with the Gulkana Village Council and the president there. And I want to thank you for allowing us to come before you guys at this time. I also, on behalf of Gulkana Village Council, would like to see that May 31st be a day that we are recognizing Katie John for her fight for cultural and traditional rights that she fought for the people of Alaska. And I think this would also be a way for all of us to pay respect to a fearful leader who stood her ground till the end of her days. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen, for taking the time to call in this afternoon for everyone, actually, from Mintassa. We don't get often that many people from one place, so I can tell it's important. So thank you. We're going to switch now to Nicole Borromeo. I hope I got that right, from the AK Federation of Natives. Nicole, can you hear us?
Mr. Karen, good afternoon, Chairman Sauer and members of the Alaska Senate State Affairs Committee. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to provide some brief comments on SB 78. I know you have a copy of our letter and resolution in your packet, so I'm going to keep this very brief and simply echo the strong support that has gone before, and particularly the comment from Senator Coghill and ANNA's managing attorney, Nick Ostrovsky. Katie John is an extraordinary Alaska Native who made significant contributions to our great state, and we should honor her spirit by declaring May 31st Katie John Day. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Nicole. And just because I think it didn't come out, but we've got it, could you go ahead and just put your full name on the record?
Oh, I apologize. Nicole Borromeo.
Thank you so much. I want to make sure I got your name kind of right, too. So thank you for calling in. Have a good afternoon. We're going to switch to the last one, and that's Kim Reitmeyer from ANCSA in Anchorage. Could you put yourself on the record, Kim, and how do you hear us?
Mr. Showers, Chairman Showers, thank you so much. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
You're loud and clear. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, please.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I am Kim Reitmeyer. I'm the executive director of the ANCSA Regional Association. We represent the presidents and the CEOs of the 12 land-based Alaska Regional Native Corporations. Our mission is to promote and foster the continued growth and economic strength of Alaska Native Corporations on behalf of our more than 130,000 shareholders. Katie John was respected by Alaskans and especially by Alaska Native people for her tireless leadership on many issues impacting our people. Ensuring traditional hunting and fishing rights are protected has been and continues to be a policy priority of the association. Our members have an acute understanding that our traditional Alaska Native way of life are the thread that binds us to our land and to our culture. Katie's many sacrifices to ensure that future generations of Alaska Native people would not be denied the rights she fought so hard to defend is why we support SB 78. I think Katie John Day is a positive and meaningful bill to honor the life that Katie has set for our Alaskan people. And we also submitted a letter to the committee and respectfully request the support.
Thank you, Kim, for taking the time to call in this afternoon.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone in the room that I missed that would like to come up and testify? I see no other callers from online or off-net, I should say. At this time, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on SB 78. If you did not get a chance to put testimony on the record, you can still submit it to senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov, and it will get on the record. At this time, I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay, State Affairs is back on the record. Is there any further deliberation from the committee on SB 78? Seeing and hearing none, what is the will of the committee as far as the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill 78, version U, from committee with individual recommendations in the attached general fiscal notes.
All right. Seeing no objection, the bill will move from committee. And we'll take a brief at ease at this time to sign the paperwork. SB 78 has moved, and we're going to go to the second item on the agenda. Is going to be an initial rollout of SB 92, PFT contributions to the general fund by Senator Wilson. At this time, I'd like to call Senator Wilson and his staff to the table, or just Senator Wilson. I think you understand the drill, sir, so when you're ready, put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District D, and today we're going to discuss the Senate Bill 92 introduction here. We've heard from many Alaskans who have expressed interest in donating a portion of their PFD or the entirety of the PFD to the general fund to help support government services and reduce the deficit. Senate Bill 92 creates a simple mechanism for those individuals to donate directly to the general fund. If you want to donate your dividend, that's your choice, and we feel that we want to give Alaskans that choice and not make it a mandatory automatic reduction. And if you want to keep your dividend, feel free to do so. That's also your choice. Senate Bill 92 is about the freedom to make your own decision. We have the bill in front of you, Mr. Chair. If you want, I can do go through a sectional analysis here.
Please.
Section 1, for its impacts, contributions to dividends. It allows a participant to electronically direct money to any educational foundation or charitable donations, and we're also just adding that piece to the general fund and of increments up to $25 up to the total amount of the PFD. And that's lines 1, 3 through 15. Continue on page 2, lines 1 through 6. This also allows the electronic depositing to include the general fund as well, and by adding sections to the general fund for those contributions. Section 2, page 2, lines 7 through 17, amends a section by adding general fund to that contribution list. Section 3, page 2, lines 18 through 22, adds to the section by adding funds to this report. That establishes the department to identify reports and listing the donations they receive. Section 4, page 3, lines 1 through 6, amends the section by adding or the general fund to the list of organizations that do not have a fee of coordination withheld. And with that fee is the 7% donations similar to Picklet Give, so that would help pay for the offset of the implementation of this bill. We've had some clarifying intent. That concludes this sectional, but we had some issues of communication with the drafter of this bill and sort of the legislative intent of what passed Senate Bill 154 that passed last year. And quickly just want to explain the amendment that I would like to see, hopefully the committee adopt, or just to make sure that clarification and intent is very specific and clear, because we also heard from a lot of stakeholders within the Pick, Click, Give community and others that we want to clarify the intent by completing a completely separate button in mechanic is, and a mechanism separate from the Pick, Click, Give section from the dividend application. We don't want to have a direct competing, well, am I going to donate with this person or this person? They felt that it would be best not to have that on that list, and we want to continue to honor that intent from last year after that agreement was made with the Pick, Click, Give organization. This in section also to include, make sure that the 7% administrative fee of the donations are there as well to help go directly to help pay for the implementation that would help go with the setup of this mechanism through the the online application process. There's some technical, some language that has to be done to include the setup of this through the online portion. With that changes, though, we noticed that there was a couple errors with that intent to make it outside of Pick, Click, Give and the statutes, and so there was also an error in the physical notes that we also asked, so I think another note will maybe come forthcoming as well with that. We felt that the state of Alaska, if you will, is a very large social organization. It funds education, it funds public health services. We do a lot in terms of transportation. It does a lot in terms of similarly, it also funds nonprofit organizations through other grants and services. And so technically, the state of Alaska is one of the most largest, if you will, charitable contributing agencies of the state of Alaska. I don't think anyone else gives as much as we as a state through the general fund to help fund state services and services that the people of Alaska depend on, need on. Regardless, outside of that, we also fund public safety, corrections, the court system. And so every item there within the general fund or services of state government, we're allowing the people of Alaska that we've heard from. I'm sure you're hopefully other members in this building. I've seen the CCs on the emails that say people say, hey, reduce my dividend or tax me. And those are the people that I want to make sure that they have an opportunity to sort of, let's do a plan, do study act. Before we plan to just cut the dividend, let's see how many of Alaskans are willing to put forth the dividend, their contribution to the state of Alaska. I want to make sure that those people have that opportunity and mechanism to willingly to basically do what they say they wanted to do within the communications that they had with my office and that they've had with other legislators in this building. With that, I'm here to answer any questions. Also available, Ann Whiskey from the Permanent Fund Director from the Permanent Fund Director of the Department of Revenue is here, and I believe the drafter of this bill, and hopefully our future CS or amendment, depending on what the committee would like to do, is also here.
Okay. Well, you have your various lifelines. We're going to start off. I know Senator Coghill had a question. A
couple questions. First of all, I actually thought about starting a nonprofit, calling it the General Fund. So,
retirement.
Do we need to specify the General Fund of the State of Alaska?
Through the chair, no. This will be a separate mechanism, and the intent would be there for the General Fund. And also the statement of where the 7% will go to as well for the administration fee of the donation.
I think we just need to be clear about that. And so, and if, especially if we're going to take it out of the pick, click, give arena, that it may be very clear. But the first, my first thought when I read this is I'm going to go out and get me a nonprofit called the General Fund. So, but we already can do this up to some degree. So explain to me what can be done now mechanically to return your dividend.
I believe there are a few Alaskans that now they can return their dividend. They can write a check to back to the state of Alaska. I believe it's to the Division of the Treasury, if I'm correct. And Ms. Weske can come up and also can talk about that. But what happens if you don't apply for a dividend, you decide, you know, I don't want to take the state's money, I don't want to apply, that money is then recalculated throughout the states, depending on how the PFD calculation is done. So if, for example, if Senator Wilson doesn't decide to take his dividend, the chairman and the other committee members will get a few more pennies added to their dividend. So it doesn't quite go back to the state general fund in that. And
yes, ma'am. Let me put yourself on the record. Can you please answer the question?
For the record, my name is Ann Weske, Permanent Fund Dividend Division Director. Through the chair, I can't remember. Was it Senator Coghill that asked that question? I'm sorry. So they would end up, the individuals do come in, not super frequently, but they do call us and ask, how can I give this money back to the state? And we do just recommend, as Senator Wilson said, we recommend that they just write a check to the division or to the Department of Revenue, and then we're able to route it to the general fund. Part of it is just that it's not well known that that's an option, so I think this would be helpful in that.
Well, follow up that question real quick since we've got you up here. Is there a cleaner way to do that if you're a citizen, if you want to put on the record, say if you wanted to not file and not have the taxes that might be held out because it's counted as income, would it not be better to just not file for a dividend? Would that be a better way to do that?
Chairman Schauer, I don't believe that that is a better way because it would wrap back into the funding. So it wouldn't be going to benefit directly the state. It would just increase everyone else's dividend by not filing.
That's why I'm asking, because I'd like to get this on the record as we have the conversation. If people have questions, which you, like you said, they do, what would be their best option? Because it also ties into the bill that Senator Wilson is proposing. So that's what I want to get out here in the discussion so people can look at this and hear it and go, here's what my intent is with my check, to have one or not. What's the best way for him to do it? And I think Senator Machicki had a comment or a question on that as well.
Well, I think that's important because we hear that, and I get all of my facts from something called Facebook because I found it to be completely accurate. But that's one of the things I see is people just don't apply for your check if you want to donate it back. And I think it's really important that we clarify that that's not how it works. That would just be distributed to the remaining 634,000 that apply for the check. But the question I had, now that that's, I think, clear for folks, since you are donating back, you're technically, the money's coming from the state, you're donating back, how is the tax treatment on that? So you're receiving a check, you're normally taxed whatever your tax bracket may be. On Pick, Click, Give, you're donating net of tax. So you pay the full taxes. This one may be different because you're technically not taking money out of the state coffers. Is there the potential for this contribution to be the proportion that you donate back to be tax-free?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Machicki. So through the IRS contribution charitable deductions, and we just grabbed this right off the web page of the of the IRS. It's in publication rules, I believe, publication 526, also in 561, and publication 117, qualified organizations. You may deduct a charitable contribution made for the use of any of the following organizations that otherwise qualify under section 170C of the Internal Revenue Code. And the first one is a state or U.S. possession thereof, or U.S. District of Columbia, if made for exclusively for public purposes. And we double check with the IRS, and the State General Fund is a public purpose.
So that, thank you for that. That's not what I'm asking.
Oh, so in terms of paying, you would still pay tax on the charitable. So I would recommend, as we did, please consult with your tax professional to figure out what your tax deduction will be off of the general fund. Would be my recommendation. Save that portion to pay for your federal taxes, and then make your other contribution if you want to do that as well.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up, Senator Chief.
Question for the Department of Revenue: can you please research whether or not that particular, if you donate, so say you get a $3,000 check, tax brackets 30%, it will cost you $900 to give $2,100 back to the state if you gave your check. Can you do a little research to determine if it's, if you're essentially receiving a check, yet it's going back to the state who's issuing the check, if that could be actually tax-free, not a deduction, but if you could donate back the entire $3,000, because it's not leaving control of the state. That's the question I'm asking. Pick, click, give, that doesn't work. But on the amount, if you decide to file for your check, yet contribute, essentially not take it, you're going to mark, if you decide to mark in the entire $3,000, can you do some research to see if it doesn't leave the state's control, if that could, the, if it could be tax-free?
Senator, yes, I'll look into that. I think I understand what you're saying. It would in essence be that you would like to receive the funds but decline having them sent to you.
Right.
So they'll never touch your bank account.
That's right.
Okay.
As a
go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Follow up. If that were to take place, that wouldn't be a tax deduction because it's never in that person's possession for that. I think we looked into this last year as well, and we can check the transcripts of, and I believe there was a long conversation up in Senate Finance last year on that item, but we would need to, the person would have to receive those funds to be able to give them back, otherwise to for the whole tax purposes. But we, the department, will look into that. But I think that was the conversation based off of last year. But we can't get around that non-taxable item that you will be taxed if you apply for a dividend. Even if the state takes it out pre, there's no net tax benefit for that.
Could you talk a little bit, since we went through this last year, this already went through and we're doing it again, on the constitutional issues of, because the questions have also been asked by folks, I get the same questions and others, well, I don't want to give it back to the general fund to be spent however. I want to give it back to the Department of Education. I want to give it back to the Department of Transportation because my roads are terrible, whatever it might be. Can you discuss the thought process behind it, and if there's a lifeline or somebody that may want to come up and explain it about the constitutional or legal issues of whether that was possible or not to do?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Article 9, Section 7 of the Constitution, dedicated funds. The Alaska State Constitution prohibits the declaration of funds specific purposes except for the permanent fund when requiring federal government or the participation in federal fund programs. So with that, you cannot direct similar to have designated funds donated to the state of Alaska constitutionally. We talked about why donors can't do that. They could always let their wishes known to their individual legislators and saying that, hey, I donated my whole PFD to education. Do you mind advocating on my behalf to fund education additionally? We also looked at creating a mechanism for that within the Pick, Click, Give program, but that would be a little cost prohibitive of the programming requirements that would entail in terms of this is my suggested place and not requirement. And maybe a report could be given to the legislature, but that would cost a little bit. It would just add an additional concept to make the donor sort of feel good about the donation of that. So that's why we sort of left that off in that, you know, all intents and purposes, just like many other nonprofit organizations, when you make a donation, it's just normally to their general fund or for their general cash account. And normally they'll say the donation is at the discretion of the agency to use. That's a lot of agencies. Catholic Social Services does that. I think of a lot of larger entities also do that as well.
And could you talk just briefly as well, if through the conversation you talked about the difference between an individual and the legislature and the constitutional ability to donate as the legislature appropriates funds, and the individual is somebody different. Did they answer that constitutional question of why a person could not versus the legislature? Because they're obviously, they looked at that differently, as I understand it. whoever, if you have a lifeline.
Chairman, I'm sorry. I would have to research that a little bit more. Okay. I don't have a good answer for that right now.
I believe it's exactly the same, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilson, that it's the same for the dedicated funds for the state, for either if it's your person or for the legislature. We can't designate funds, and so you can't give money and say, I want this money designated for that, because the individual may donate the money, but it's the legislature that appropriates it. And so the appropriating power is still within the legislature and not with the individual.
Okay, thank you. And I think Senator Kawasaki had a question.
Sure. I wanted to hear a little bit more about the tax implications, too. And so if that research comes, please share it with the committee. The question I had was maybe for Ms. Weske. There were questions about if we add, like the education lottery that was a bill last year, if we add that in, suddenly it'll dilute the amount of money that people are charitable giving to, say, Picklet Give. And can you tell me if that is the case or not? And if you have those numbers, because it just closed, I know we can get maybe some firmed up numbers.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, we were actually really pleased to see that the numbers didn't come to the detriment of any other program. The education raffle is just under $1 million, and that one is done at this point. Picklet Give was just under $3 million, and so they were pleased with the numbers. The number of donors remained consistent for college savings as well as the Picklet Give program, and it seemed to be a completely different audience, an additional audience that gave to the education raffle. So I think everybody was pleased with that and maybe even a little bit surprised.
Sure. I guess
those were good results.
Bishop, an apology then?
Yeah, you might.
On the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Before we go there, you mentioned what the numbers were, but you didn't say anything. You mentioned education, but didn't say a number. Did you have a number for that, a percentage or an actual monetary number to go with it?
Chairman, yes, that's just under $1 million.
Okay. I thought you were talking about something entirely separate. I got it. My apologies. Senator Michicki.
So if you couldn't break it out by department, why is the crime victim and this may be Department of Law questions, but why is the crime victim compensation fund on the peace officer and firefighter survivors fund on here? I don't believe either were pre-statehood dedicated funds.
And Ledge Legal was online if I need to go to them.
Yes, I may have to go to the drafter.
Okay. We have Emily on the line. If Emily, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Did you hear that question?
I did, and I believe I can answer it for the record. This is Emily Namlin with Legislative Legal through the chair. It's my understanding that although the legislature retains the power of appropriation, the amounts to those funds are considered sort of designated program receipts, and that they go in that long list of things that the legislature considers to be designated, and they do go to those sources. Usually, of course, that's subject to appropriation by the legislature ultimately.
So, Mr. Chairman, that means you actually probably could do to a department, although it may be cost prohibitive. And the reason I asked about the tax, because if people actually wanted to give to a specific state cause, if you're paying the $900 in tax using a $3,000 dividend, I would get the check and bring it to my kid's school, right? So that question's very important. If I didn't have to pay the $900 and I were going to donate my PFD back, I'd probably go through the state program. If I did have to pay the $900, it'd probably go to the PTA. I mean, it's just a consideration. So that question's important, as well as the dedicated fund, because I don't think that fits here necessarily. But it'd be interesting to know the cost if you did the other departments, if that would be substantially more costly.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe that's a question that Emily can also answer as well.
Emily, you still there? Want to take a shot at that?
I am still here. Sorry, I was on mute.
That's okay.
I didn't understand the question. I don't think if you could repeat it, that would be great.
You bet. Senator Michicki will repeat the question.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Emily. My question is, if designated general funds are okay from outside, then you would be able to do the individual departments That's separate than the tax question I asked about, but it seems like since the Crime Victim Compensation Fund and Peace Officer and Firefighter Survivors Fund is in there, that if you wanted to expand that scope instead of just the general fund to the other departments, it seems like that would be legal and not and would not compromise the dedicated fund clause.
Through the chair to Senator Machicki, that's consistent with my current understanding that it would be possible to sort of attempt to direct the money to specific purpose. Ultimately, of course, the Constitution reigns and it would be subject to appropriation, but the money likely would be sort of earmarked in a similar way to the other program receipts.
Senator Wilson, you want to talk to that? Because I saw the shake of the head there with the thoughts on the cost and maybe answer a little bit of what you found out before.
No, Mr. Chair, I just was trying to pass a bill without trying to send it to a legal to the Supreme Court to have it challenged later on. That was all.
Okay. Did you have any data on cost, by the way, when you said it was cost prohibitive when you looked at it before?
Mr. Chair, we would have to – actually, Ms. Wesky was the one that we were dealing with last year on the issue of the programming. So every time we do a change in the programming or the feature of the website, it was adding additional cost to our piece of legislation.
Care to take a stab at a memory, random neural?
Chairman, I believe each program is relatively $10,000 per year with programming for initial startup, and then we usually have about $1,200 to $1,800 per year for just upkeep of ensuring that report. Every program who joins tends to want reports throughout the year, so that covers, you know, all the reporting costs that we provide, updates to just revamping the application. Every application year there's new technology, so we're creating and programming new things, so it helps go into the costs of all the charitable portion of our application.
Okay. Other questions right now from the committee? Senator Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I also want to put out there on the record too that where there was a concern for people that kids that may be in custody of OCS or that as well, and that for the child in need of aid, the China cases, that money is actually in statute and provision that the department has to put that money in a trust for that child until the child either is out of custody or that child is turns to the age of 18. So that is already in section 47.10. .115 of the permanent fund dividend of about what happens with children that are within state custody or not within their own parental custody as well.
Okay. Seeing no other questions for now, if you guys want to go ahead and exit out of the hot seat, we're going to open up public testimony. Thank you, Senator Wilson and Ms. Wesky, for coming up. This time, open up public testimony on Senate Bill 92. Looks like we do have somebody calling in online. Mike Prax, can you hear us, sir?
I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Mike Prax calling from Fairbanks, and I'm just representing myself. And I have to confess I had to take a prescription strength and a cynicism pill to make this call. But at any rate, I would encourage you to pass this bill and get the program going. I understand the concerns about taxes and dedicated funds and this and that and the other, but there certainly does need to be an opportunity for those who say they want to give their money back to the state to make it as easy as possible for them to do that. And then if there's other details, they can be fixed next year, the year after, or whatever. It'll be modified like a lot of other things. But I think it's important to get this program going to give those people a chance. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mike, for taking the time to call in this afternoon. Okay. I don't see anybody else that has called in. Do I have anyone in the room that would like to testify? Okay. Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to close public testimony this time. And well, does anybody have any other comments they want to make in this one? I'm planning on setting this bill aside based on the sponsor's comments of wanting to look at a CS. So we'll go ahead and discuss that after. So for the moment, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. If there was anybody else that wanted to testify on this one in the meantime, while Senate State Affairs is holding it, senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov, and we'll get your written testimony on the record. All right, we're going to go on to our third agenda item of the day. It's an initial rollout, or the rollout of SB 40, Black History Month, by Senator Gray Jackson. This time, I'd like to call Senator Gray Jackson and her staff to the table, please. I guess your time is up. Remember, move fast in this committee, LV. Move fast. Okay, when you're ready, please go ahead and put yourself on the record, both of you, and then you can provide your intro to the bill.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee, for this opportunity to speak on SB 40, establishing February as Black History Month. Alaska continues to face monumental challenges. We all recognize that, and there are more important issues this legislature has been working through this session, but at the same time, we can't forget matters that recognize our citizens within the many diverse communities that exist throughout our state. Anchorage happens to be one of the most diverse communities in the nation. When I was growing up in New Jersey, Black history was not taught in schools. Fortunately, it is now, and our children are discovering that many households and other items were invented by a Black person. For example, Sarah Boone, ironing board, Richard Spikes, automatic gear shift, George T. Sampson, clothes dryer, Alexander Miles, automatic elevator doors, Alice Parker, gas heating furnace, Dr. George Grant, golf tee, Philip Downey, mailbox, Washington Martin, modern toilet, Otis Boykin, pacemaker, George Crumb, potato chips, Garrett Morgan, traffic light. Mr. Chairman, in January, we celebrated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service. Dr. King was my personal hero, and he paved the way for me to be here today serving in the Alaska State Senate. There are also many other African-American leaders that continue to shape this nation and Alaska. One of those leaders was the late Senator Betty Davis. She devoted her life to helping the poor and the disenfranchised. She was a staunch public health advocate while also doing everything in her power to build a strong public education system where everyone, no matter your background, would have the opportunity to succeed. She was awesome, and she was someone we all knew and we respected. And for me to follow in the legacy of the late Senator Betty Davis, the first African-American woman to serve in the Senate, it is truly an honor. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, please join me in formally recognizing the many accomplishments of African Americans throughout Alaska by enshrining in statute Black History Month. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to refer to Jaden Hodson for additional comments. Jaden?
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Jaden Hodson.
Hold the microphone a little farther forward. Sorry. Or closer to you. Closer. Yep. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jaden Hodson, intern to Senator Gray Jackson. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today on SB 40, a bill establishing February as Black History Month. Found in your packet is SB 40. Currently, Black History Month is not recognized in state statute and only done through resolution. The sponsor has introduced legislation which formally declares February as Black History Month. At the national level, formal recognition of February as Black History Month has been celebrated since 1976. However, Alaska does not currently recognize Black History Month except through annual resolution here in the legislature and at the local level. In your packet is the fiscal note for this legislation. Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note is a $0 effect. And that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions from you or the committee members, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you for your intro to the bill from both of you. I'll go ahead and open it up to the committee at this time for questions or comments. Senator Cago.
Thank you. Well, thank you, too, for doing this. And it's just been my experience that the resolution was brought forward because of the national issue, and it raised the level up. Do you see any incongruency of going ahead and putting the statute that it won't bring to light the thing that a resolution normally does? Because normally what happens is a resolution is brought forward, and it's a way of creating attention. This may, maybe because of federal law, the tension is already there pretty much. Do you see any value in keeping the resolution, or do you think a resolutions would be pointing to that, or do you think this would be the platform that most people would work off of? Have you thought that through at all?
Through the chairman, absolutely. For those of you who don't know, I was on the Anchorage Assembly for 9 years, and I brought forward a resolution for Black History Month and other cultural events that happen in the community every single year. And I was determined that if I ever made it to the legislature, that I wasn't going to do a resolution. I was going to bring forward a bill to make it state statute. And every single year in my community in Anchorage, there is a full whole month of activities that happened. And I can guarantee you, as long as I'm in the legislature, and I'm planning on being here a while, that it will be recognized in the same manner that it is when there's a resolution brought forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill, follow up.
Point well taken. Your tenacity probably will definitely prevail. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Just a really quick question.
Yeah, Senator Kawasaki.
So thank you. Thank you for presenting the legislation, and whoever can answer it. Is the federal one known as African American Heritage Month, or is it also known as Black History Month?
Through the chair, I believe it's Black History Month. In our provided testimony or provided supporting documents, they referred to 1976 as Black History Month, so I am relying on the provided supporting documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Yeah, personally, one of the things I'm always cautious of is, and I think it came from being in the military, is that it didn't matter what color you are because we all bled red. It didn't matter if you're black, white, you know, red, brown, any different color. It was all the same. So I'm always cautious of anything that could possibly divide us, even though we already had the issues, because I look at everybody as American first. Everything else is just an adjective. It's a qualifier to something of just who you are. And I don't look at people based on something they can't control, you know, born a man or a woman or a different color, because, again, we're all the same. I think the military does that really well. It teaches you that you come together from diverse backgrounds and you realize everybody's the same. I mean, they have the same hopes, dreams, fears. They have different experiences that got them there and certainly have experienced racism and prejudice. But I think the part of me that comes out, I'm like, well, we're American first. And after that, we solve our problems together. I'm not against a bill like this. That's not my point of saying is I, just me personally, everything I look at, I look through the lens of, like, does it divide us at all? Because I need us to come together. We need to come together right for issues. But celebrating history of what a culture has brought to our overall culture, so that's a different kind of a thing. So,
Mr. Chairman, can I make a comment?
You bet you can. That's why you're here.
I understand exactly where you're coming from, and I agree with you. But the fact of the matter is we were not always the same. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, we
Chairman.
Were not. No, and this is not to debate it. It's like I said, I will freely acknowledge. I grew up in the South. I saw racism firsthand from my own family, how they treated people back in the day. I get it, where it comes from. I just hope that we continue to move down the path. It's an interesting experiment with America because we have our problems. I mean, I've been all over the world and I've seen racism against, you know, you can go even to within religions, Sunni versus Shia, killing each other more than they're killing people outside of that, you know, in their own wars. So you can talk about racism I've seen in Asia. You go back to World War II. Between the Japanese, the Koreans, the Chinese, it was terrible. And then it was all because they just kind of hated each other for why? I mean, because you're across a border, across an ocean. It's as strange as we go through that. And yet the interesting thing about the American experiment is some ways we're self-correcting because we've made it institutionalized where it's no longer acceptable, but it takes time to change hearts and minds. And it's just sometimes ignorance. People look at it and they're afraid of somebody else because they're different. Different color, different background, different religion. And we need to get over that. And that's why I said my lens I looked through, but the military did that to me after 24 years, was everybody's really the same. Down deep, we got to get past the stuff on the surface. And sometimes, but you still celebrate how we got here. So long speech to say nothing in particular other than I'm very cognizant of keeping us less divided and more united as a nation, because a house divided against itself will fall. And we need to be very cognizant of that. So for that being said, if you guys don't mind staying just in case, we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony at this time because we actually have a caller in at this time. So just to make sure, any other comments from the committee, questions? Opening up public testimony. We have on the line, I might get the last name wrong, we have Celeste Hodge Gruden from Anchorage. Celeste, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You're loud and clear. Could you put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony, please?
Sure. Good morning. For the record, my name is Celeste Hodge Gruden, and I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 40. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator L.B. Gray Jackson for bringing this bill forward. I've served as the president of the NAACP for nearly a decade in the 80s, and most recently as the president of the Shiloh Community Development Incorporated. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization that empowers youth, minorities, and the disadvantaged to improve lives. The organization's goal is to enhance the quality of life of those less fortunate by providing transitional assistance, economical and educational opportunities, job search support, health education, prevention and wellness programs, and youth mentorship. The major emphasis of SCDI is to develop and promote programs that advance minorities, youth, and the disadvantaged in health, education, justice, and economic development. I am proud to say SCDI is the organization that organized the first Betty Davis African American Summit, Moving Towards Hope Together, during February in celebration of Black History Month. We felt it was important to host the summit in February. We raised our own money from overwhelming community support to host the entire day program. In addition, SCDI received a $10,000 grant from Alaska Community Foundation to support SCDI's Media Justice Project. It's a storytelling effort designed to recognize and communicate throughout the state the contributions of local African Americans. These vignettes aired throughout the state on various television stations the entire month of February. During Black History Month in schools, yes, you learn about Black history, but you learn about national individuals like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks and slavery. But we know there's so much more to Black history. Through these vignettes, we learned about the first Black dentist, who was Dr. Josh Wright, or the first Black attorney, which was Ashley Dickerson, and yes, the first Black elected female in the House of Representatives, and who also served as the first Black male or female senator, Betty Davis. 10 individuals were showcased. It's important to recognize the contributions of African Americans, and I urge the passage of Senate Bill 40. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Celeste, for taking the time to call in this afternoon. I would add to that, I think I have one person on your list I was upset with. I wish you would have invented something different than the potato chip. I think that's been the downfall of many of us in this life. I will tell you one thing interesting, Elvie, that has struck me, and I know you've seen it, but the Red Tails, or you go back to the Tuskegee Airmen. I had a chance over on a number of occasions to sit down with many of them being a fighter pilot and had a lot of really interesting conversations with those gentlemen and what they went through back in the day. And I realized what was different. The only thing that was different was skin color. Had the same desire to get in that airplane and fly and go after the bad guys and do their thing. And it was interesting to get a different perspective from them because we all actually felt the same. We talked the same. Everything was the same except what they had to go through to get there. I also had a chance to sit down with the first Black astronaut as well from NASA and had a chance to speak with them. And it's really interesting to hear the perspective. A little different by then than it was certainly World War II. But you go back to the World War II time frame, and there's just like the Japanese Americans that were serving, the same thing. It's interesting the things, the divides we had to overcome to get people to do the same mission that other people are volunteering to do. It was an interesting hurdle when you think about they're out there wanting to fight for the same country that when they come home is then treating them differently from everybody else. So lessons learned in history that hopefully won't be forgotten, which is why I said we're celebrating that kind of cultural side of this. Is there anyone that I missed in the room that would like to testify? Okay. At that time, Elvie, you guys can clear off of the hot seat. Thank you for coming up and testifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
We'll go ahead and close public testimony. And just very briefly, we're going to take an at ease. Since we no further comments or debate from the committee, what is the will of the committee, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill number 40, version A, from committee with individual recommendations, and there is no fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 40 moves from committee. At this time, we're going to take it at ease, and we're going to sign the paperwork, and we'll come back on the record to take a recess until 3:30. Vice Chairman, could you restate the motion to move the bill, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, the I move that we go ahead and move the Senate Bill 40 as we did previously, but it has come to my attention that we actually do have a fiscal note, so with the attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 40 again has moved from committee. We're going to take an ad to sign the paperwork. Affairs back on the record. Okay, at this time, just for the record, we're going to go ahead and take a recess. We will be back at 3:30, where we'll be bringing up SJR5 at that time. So we're in recess at 3:30. Thank you. Go ahead and call State Affairs, Senate State Affairs back to order after a recess. Time is currently 3:41 p.m. This time we're going to bring back up SJR5, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund, and Dividend. Committee last heard this bill on Thursday, March 28th, and since opened and closed public testimony. And I would continue to ask the public if you have testimony you'd like to give us at this point, you can send it to senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov, and it will be submitted for the written record. This time, I'd like to go ahead and call back up Mr. Milks with the Department of Law, who has some follow-up remarks from the last meeting. So this time, coming up, put yourself on record, and we'll get those things answered.
Good afternoon. Bill Milks, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. So first on the follow-up questions, I recall there was a question or two raising it about sort of the effect of if the amendment was passed as proposed, what about an issue such as garnishments or hold harmless provisions on public benefits. What the amendment seeks to do here is to provide that the dividend program that would be adopted into the Constitution and established at the beginning, that the dividend program would be the current statutory program. So subject to change by the legislature, approved by the voters. But that program is really focused on specific statutory formula that calculates the amount of income that is produced from the permanent fund income that's transferred for the availability of dividends, and then a statutory requirement regarding eligibility to receive a dividend. So the intent of this bill is not, there are certainly, once you are eligible for a dividend, that there can be other issues created because you now possess a dividend or are eligible one for one. So something like garnishment would not be covered under this amendment. There wouldn't be a requirement to submit to the voters legislative changes about how perhaps garnishment would work in relation to your receipt of a PFD. I think that was the primary question, I believe, was the sort of ancillary issues that address once you have the entitlement to a dividend.
Okay. Senator Machigi? Which leaves in place the fact that if you changed it to from 180 days to or 180 days to 90 day maximum absentee, or if you changed how many years you can be out of state, if you happen to be in the military or a student, or any of those other issues, those would have to go before the voters.
Through the chair, correct, Senator Machigi.
Other questions, comments at this time? Anyone so far? Okay. Anything else, Mr. Mills?
No.
Okay. No. All right. We have done that. Today, I've got two amendments I'm going to offer the committee for consideration. It's my intent to move this out after these amendments are taken up, if we get to that. Oops, wrong page. Sorry. Somebody asked Vice Chair Cockill if you could move amendment number one, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll move amendment number one, which is A.3.
I'll go ahead and object for purposes of explanation and discussion. And at this point, these are conforming or technical changes, I should say, that were added in as Ledge Legal took a look at the documents. So, Mr. Milks, I know we had talked about it. If you want to make any highlights, that the Department of Law was comfortable with the changes and they made sense and there was no objections to those from the perspective of the Department of Law.
Chairman, that's correct. They are technical. Each of them are just technical changes that Legislative Legal Services thought would further clarify the amendment. And Department of Law has no objection to them, can see the benefit of them. I think the first one that you have before you is A3.
That is correct, A.3 from Ledge Legal.
So that one just clarifies that the legislature, when it passed a bill changing the permanent fund dividend program, that the legislature could provide a later effective date for the bill. And it tracks the language that's in the Constitution on providing for a later effective date based on a two-thirds vote of membership at each house. And I would note, of course, the committee had another proposed amendment before it a week ago or so regarding taxation, and this is just about identical language, I think.
Okay. And could you talk to the second after governor? It's changing or an effective date provided by the concurrence of two-thirds of membership each house. I think you really just combined them both together, didn't you, when you explained that?
Yes, and the second one, A4, is essentially just clarifying that when we talk about a law passed by the legislature to change the dividend program, that it is subject to a vote of the people. So it's essentially a, just like with the other amendment we discussed, essentially clarifying this is a contingent law. It's a law passed by a legislature contingent on approval by the voters.
All right. For the committee, like I said, this came from our Ledge Legal, but they're wanting to change the language slightly. Department of Law has looked at it, has no issues. So does anybody else have further questions or comments for those amendments? Okay. Seeing no further comments, I will remove my objection. Is there any further comments? If there's no objection at this time, then we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee, or excuse me, the amendment from the committee. And Senator Coghill, could you move amendment number two, please? So don't want to take it out. I missed something there. State Fair is back on the record. We're going to make the motion to move the disregard. Stop. Amendment number one passes. Thank you. I got to repeat the process. So let's go. Could we move amendment number two,
Mr. Chairman? Senator? I move amendment number two, which is A.4.
Okay. Thank you. And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. And basically, we'll do the same thing. This also came from Ledge Legal. And it's the continuing technical changes. So since we don't have them here on the line to explain, but it is technical from them, and we have coordinated with the Department of Law, Mr. Milks, would you mind just validating the same as we did before, see if there's any questions we'll ask?
Chair, yes. I'm sorry. I might have jumped ahead a few minutes ago.
It's okay.
This amendment's the one that clarifies that a law passed amending the change in the permanent fund dividend program passed by the legislature is not effective unless the voters approve that law. So it's essentially a contingency provision. Legislative Legal thought it should be clarified in the way the amendment provides, and we reviewed, Department of Law reviewed that proposed amendment and agree it makes sense, provides further clarification, and it's consistent with the same amendment we saw a week ago on another amendment regarding taxation.
Okay. And you can see the following three is just proposed deleting the language. So, again, does anybody have any questions, comments on this one from them? The law is happy with it. Our department is happy with it. Okay, I'll remove my objection at this time. And is there any further discussion on amendment number two? Are there any objections to moving the amendment? Seeing none, amendment number two passes. I am not going to offer amendment number three at this time, so we are done with those at that point. Is there any further discussion on, and thank you, Mr. Gibbs, you can clear off. Is there any further discussion on SJR 5 at this time? Seeing or hearing none, I'll ask Vice Chairman. Yeah, go
Mr.
ahead.
Chairman, if
actually,
sorry.
Take it. Go ahead. Senator Coghill.
There are some lingering questions, I think legal questions, that I hope that as this bill moves on into the next committee that you'll begin to ask, and that is we're inserting statutory language that really is going to tie the hand of the legislature on some things that may need to be moved, as it was brought up, qualification issues, timing issues. So I'm hoping that that as we get into the Judiciary Committee, those things are addressed again.
Thank you, Senator Coghill, and they are. You can see that I had an amendment that started to address those issues. I just didn't feel that with the time available that I was quite prepared to go into the debate and discussion on them, but they will be those and probably a few others are going to be offered in Judiciary in the next committee of referral to because there are concerns. When we talk about the Constitution, we need to take this one very seriously because we're talking about long-term changes with a high hurdle to jump over. So thank you. Any other comments while we're at it? Just make sure. Okay. Seeing or hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and ask Vice Chair Senator Coghill to make the motion to move the resolution from the committee. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate State Affairs Committee move the Senate Joint Resolution Number 5, version 31 GS 1072, version A, as amended with the accompanying fiscal notes and authorizing legislative legal to make the appropriate technical and conforming changes.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. With that, SJR 5 has moved from committee. We'll take Anise to sign the paperwork. Addie to sign the paperwork. State Affairs back to order. We're going to bring back up SB 32 at this time, Crime, Sentencing, Mental Illness, Evidence. Committee last heard this bill about a month ago, so it's been some time at this point. So what we're going to do today, the intent for the committee and those watching online, is to essentially re-blue and change our brains back from the constitutional amendments we've been looking at for some time to crime. I will remind us all that we are treating this bill at this point like both the State Affairs Policy Committee but also Judiciary, because this bill will go directly to Finance after this due to the 44 conflict issues that the Judiciary Chair has with this bill and had to pass it out of committee. So we are going to take a deep dive on this one. We're going to act like multiple committees, and this one's going to take us some time. And we do have Casey with us in the room to go over this, but we have Mr. Henderson online from Anchorage, who is going to go over the what in essence is a mini sectional without much detail, just to get us back in the frame of mind for SB 32. I would also remind everybody this is kind of a foundational document for the suite of crime bills that are moving through the legislature at this time. So that being said, Mr. Henderson, can you hear us?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I can. Thank you very much.
Can you go ahead and put yourself on the record? And then, as I know you've already coordinated, kind of give us the re-blue and get ourselves back into a crime state of mind for SB 32, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Department of Law. So, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, SB 32 is a foundational aspect to the administration's crime package or crime suite of crime bills. And I'm going to start with classification first, a couple of the main aspects of this bill. The first part of SB 32 is what it does to our drug laws. So SB 32 returns all of our drug laws back to where they were pre-2016. It resets that stage, and the main effect of that include returning drug possession of any of our what we describe as our most dangerous, most hardcore drugs, our Schedule 1A or 2A controlled substances, returns the possession of those drugs back to a felony. So it's a Class C felony offense, and under the current law, a Class C felony offense with no criminal history faces a presumptive term of 0 to 2 years. It also resets the stage on drug distribution. One of the things that under the current law, drug distribution was changed, and the amount somebody was trafficking in, the amount of drugs that somebody had and they were distributing was a primary factor as to the classification of the offense. So if somebody was trafficking in a small amount, it was a C felony, and if somebody was trafficking in a larger amount, it was a B felony. What SB 32 does is it takes us back to where we were before 2016, and if somebody is trafficking or distributing, selling any amount of a 1A controlled substance, that is your heroines, your fentanyl, your carfentanil, if you're trafficking in any of that, those 1A controlled substances, it's a Class A felony. If you're trafficking in what we in the law say as a 2A or 3A controlled substance, so either your methamphetamines or your cocaines, if you're distributing in any of those 2 or 3A controlled substances, it's a B felony. This is an important distinction because one of the things that I mentioned earlier was that under the current law, the amount you're trafficking in is a defines where what level of offense you're committing. Under the prior law and under SB 32, the amount somebody is trafficking in is one factor in determining how serious that offense is. Under the law under the law prior to the change in 2016 and the way the law would be applied with SB 32 is that the court would assess the level, the amount the person is trafficking in as to whether that's a large amount or a small amount. But it would also, the court would also take into other factors. For example, where are you trafficking in? If you're trafficking heroin in Kotzebue, that's different than trafficking heroin in Anchorage. And the reason I say it's a factor is because of the impact it has on the various communities. And that necessarily includes the commercial value of that drug. The court takes into account the manner in which somebody traffics the drug. So are they possessing firearms? Are they using other individuals as part of their trafficking scheme? These are all factors that go into account. These are all factors that come into play when the court is identifying the appropriate sanction for that conduct. And then finally, with regard to the drug laws, the last main change would be the SB 32 returns the manufacture of methamphetamine back to an A felony. So under current law, if somebody is manufacturing methamphetamine, it is a B felony. SB 32 would return the manufacture of methamphetamine and the manufacture, specifically the methamphetamine around children, back to an A felony. That's the first large aspect of SB 32 is it's the return of our drug laws back to where they were pre 2016. The next,
Robert, can you hold on for a second? We've got a question from Senator Kawasaki.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Henderson, for being online today. Just a handful of questions. The first one was just a clarification on. You mentioned something about Kotzebue and how the crime would be considered different. I can't remember exactly how you phrased it. Can you go back over that really quickly?
Through the chair, Senator. Yes, absolutely. So the reason I use Kotzebue as an example is because I can tell you from my professional experience and DPS can provide additional information on this. The value of a substance like heroin, the street value of a substance like heroin in Kotzebue is much different than the street value of that same substance in Anchorage, and it's just supply and demand. And the reason why that's important is because heroin both is a very dangerous and deadly drug to ingest, but it's also a very dangerous and deadly drug to traffic in. And so there's increased danger and increased value. The risks associated with drug trafficking are greater. And so in our smaller communities where these drugs have such a huge impact, making sure that the court has the authority to take into account that a person is bringing drugs into some of our smaller communities versus bringing it into, say, Anchorage. It's just one factor that the court should be able to consider in determining what the appropriate sentence is for that trafficking offense.
Follow-up, Senator Kawasaki, please.
And there's no, I don't know how you'd consider it, just equal protection issues by doing it that way?
Through the chair, Senator, no, there's not, and let me explain why. So under SB 32, we would return the trafficking of heroin to a Class A felony offense. A person who is convicted of a Class A felony offense under this bill would be sentenced to a presumptive term of 5 to 8 years. And so the court then can impose a sentence between that 5 to 8 years. The court can also depending on the circumstances, find that the offense should be aggravated if the person was trafficking in a large amount, and the court can mitigate the sentence if the person was trafficking in a small amount. And it's those aggravators and mitigators that allow the court to depart from that presumptive range. It's for those reasons why it wouldn't be an equal protection concern. So before 2016, we had a very robust area of case law, the case is called Knight, that talk about how the court should look at the large amount aggravator and the small amount mitigator as it affects drug trafficking throughout Alaska.
Sorry, Josh, I'll begin.
That's good. I have other questions, though. I'm not
sure. Are you, continue.
Unless you're, are you done with the classifications section, or do you still have more on classifications?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm done with the drugs overview.
Then
so there are other classifications that I can touch upon, too.
I've got a handful of questions dealing with the classifications, raising the classifications. There's a lot of folks that have a heroin addiction now. I guess I have more of a policy question on possessing any amount of a Class 1A, which includes heroin. Right now, currently under the Senate Bill 91 scenario, it's a much lower crime, Class A misdemeanor. Does raising it to a Class C felony include automatic jail time?
Through the chair, Senator, it does not include automatic jail time. And let me expand on that answer a little bit. So under the current law, under SB 91, a person who is convicted of possession of heroin, personal use amounts of heroin that they're not trafficking in, is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. And they're guilty of a Class A misdemeanor, and the court is actually prohibited from imposing any jail time, active jail time, initially on the first offense. The maximum sentence a person can receive under the first offense for possession is 90 days with 90 days suspended. On the second offense of the person being convicted of possession of heroin, under the current law, the court is still prohibited from imposing any jail time. The maximum sentence is 180 days with 180 days suspended. It's not until that third offense that any active jail time is permitted. Under SB 32, what we'd be doing is moving it up to a Class C felony offense, which is the presumptive range is 0 to 2 years. So the judge still has the authority not to impose any jail time if the judge finds that appropriate. The judge does, though, have the discretion to impose jail time if the judge feels that it's appropriate for whatever the reasons the judge deems are appropriate. For example, the judge wants to ensure that the person receives credit for residential treatment and wants to order the person to residential treatment. To allow the court to do that, the court needs to have the ability to impose certain jail time. The other aspect that the other tool that we have now that we didn't have before 2016 is the suspended entry of judgment, and that would be available for somebody who is convicted of a drug possession Class C felony under SB 32. And a suspended entry of judgment allows the prosecution, the defense, and the court to all agree, and then the prosecution, the defense, enter into agreement that if the offender does all the things that we ask them to do on probation, the case is then dismissed, and the judgment is not entered.
Okay. I've got another separate question.
Continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Henderson. On the Schedule 6A, including cannabis, marijuana, would that impact the current legal industry?
Through the chair, Senator, no, it wouldn't. So I believe I testified to this during our sectional overview, that the language in SB 32 and the criminal penalties that it would attach to the trafficking of marijuana and the possession of marijuana, that is outside of and distinct from the marijuana industry and the regulation of marijuana. We've also discussed, and I think we discussed it at the last hearing, a potential amendment to clarify that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Other questions? Senator Machicki.
Yeah, that was very important to a lot of Alaskans, and I do have an amendment, Senator Kawasaki, to clarify that it does not affect essentially, it would be something like except as authorized in AS 17, which is where the legal marijuana industry statute is housed.
Thank you.
Senator Coghill, do you have one? Not sure. Okay. Anybody else at the moment? Okay. No? It comes back up on Tuesday.
I have one question.
Go ahead. Senator Machicki has a question for you.
Yeah, just, and we've talked to Ms. Schroeder about this before as well on the suspended imposition of sentence stuff. Just clarifying, and I got to admit I wasn't paying attention for a moment, so I hope you didn't cover this. But on returning drug possession to a felony, there are other avenues that the department has for actually not even convicting as a felony, having a suspended imposition of sentence, and there's another half of that. I'm sorry, it's not coming to mind right now, but you could essentially give that person a chance to turn their life around as kind of conditions of their conviction, and if they were to do so successfully, they would not either have a felony on their record or they would have a suspended felony if they fulfilled all those conditions. So I just wanted to make it clear that the way that I view this piece is that it would be both a carrot and a stick, helping someone to turn their life around that had kind of fallen to addiction, yet they would have the chance of a clear record if they were to actually successfully go through a treatment program. So I wanted that on the record again. We talked about it in the past, but that exists in current law, even if it was recriminalized, such as we see in Senate Bill 32, we would still have the ability to reward people for changing their lives.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. You can obviously stay on the phone for just a little bit longer, but I can see everybody's kind of winding down on some of the questions at the moment. I think we're all a bit, hate to say burned out, but we've all been constitutionalized in the last 2 weeks, plus a few other things here. So we've had a lot on the docket. So what I'm going to do now this time is, like I said, we are going to take a much deeper dive on this because we get to put our judiciary hats on, so those legal questions is what I expect us to be digging down to in SB 32. I have a lot of questions as the Department of Law and others. We're going to invite a few other agencies to come in that we don't normally see in state affairs, since we're going to treat this, like I said, as a judiciary committee as well. And we're going to take that deep dive on the entire bill. So more will be coming back next week as we go through. What's that? Oh, sorry about that. Next week, so bring your questions and any amendments and changes, because we're going to go through all those before we kick this out to finance, and we're going to see this bill probably for at least another week and a half or so, I would imagine, at least. So this bill is going to come back before this committee 2, 3, 4 more times probably at this point as we go through it. So expect that, and I'm going to go ahead and end the pain for today for all of us in this committee so we can switch our hats off for next Tuesday. At that time, or at this time, concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting back here on Tuesday, April 9th, 3:30, for the short session to get a rollout of SB 10. Senator Kawasaki's bill extends Suicide Prevention Council, and we're going to continue back up with SB 92 PFD contributions to the general fund. Hopefully get that done with Senator Wilson's bill, and then we're going to continue on with SB 32, Crime Sentencing, Mental Illness, and Evidence. Seeing no other business before the committee, we'll adjourn. Let the record... It's okay. Sure. Okay, then we'll let the record reflect the time is 4:16 p.m.